Osiris.
Hello.
Hello.
We are live. I knew we were going live, but I shouldn't have taken a bite of a granola bar right before we went live, but I did. So, Brian, let me ask you, how are you?
I'm doing great. I got to tell you guys, I'm ready to be spiritualized. I'm ready to testify. I'm ready to be identified. I don't know, whatever ides there are out there. I am so ready to dive into the world of the boss. I even sent the link for the show to my parents today. That's how excited I am.
That is amazing. That is Brian Brinkman. My name is RJ, and we have Matt Dwyer here with us with the hands again. Hey, Matt.
The hands. Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good. Matt is actually physically about 3/10 of a mile from me, but he's in a different location. So, guys, we're moving on. We're moving on from Dave Matthews. We did 10 live Dave Matthews shows, and that was more Dave Matthews than I've listened to in my entire life. And I learned a lot, but I'm psyched to turn to the boss. And I know you guys both are either as psyched as I am or maybe more. Matt, how do you feel about this next series?
I am so stoked. I am a lifelong Springsteen fan, and I feel like I don't get a chance to talk about the boss and the E Street Band as much as I would like to. It's usually with one of the two of you when I'm having these conversations, so I think it's awesome that we're taking this out to the people, bring it to the people, and we're hopefully gonna make some converts, because I know, you know, the boss is like maybe not the favorite of a lot of people who are around our age, but those who have been converted have seen the light and have had the experience of bathing in the greatness of the E Street Band. And I think we need to bring it to the people.
We do.
There's so much, Brian. How do you want to? I know you've been thinking about this a lot. How do you want to preview this?
I feel like the best way to get into this is just to like very quickly go through what the boss means to each of us as music fans and kind of how we've evolved as listeners to Bruce Springsteen. Because I mean, for me, just to like throw it out there, like Bruce Springsteen is there with like two other artists, being the Beatles and U2, as like the reason why I care about music. And I've gone through like a lot of evolution with listening to this artist since I was probably even before I have memories. And so to like talk about him at this state, to talk about him from a live show perspective rather than the studio albums, which is usually where I've gone to first, I think I'm going to learn a lot. I already've learned a lot getting ahead in a few of these episodes, and I can't wait to dive into this.
Before we do that, speaking of live shows, we had an amazing show on Monday night at Ardmore. Matt and I were there together. We learned a lot. We had a lot of fun. It was a really great night. We just announced a new show yesterday, a new live show. Brian, do you want to tell folks about that, and I'll tell them about the other one? We announced two shows yesterday, which is exciting.
We announced two shows yesterday, one of which will be taking place on Thursday, August 11th at the Cooperage in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. This will be taking place right before the Alpine Run. So if you are heading into the Midwest ahead of Fish's 3-night run at Alpine, come and join us at the Cooperage for a night of music and conversation featuring one of my favorite singer-songwriters, Riley Walker, a dude who has connections to the last band that we talked about. He did an excellent cover album of Dave Matthews Band's The Lily White Sessions back in 2018. He made my favorite record of 2021. His live shows are stunning, great mix of kind of freak folk, really awesome banter, and a lot of really cool jamming. So RJ and I will be there to do an interview with Riley. Get your tickets at the link here on the screen. If you are listening to this, it is osirispod.com/osirislive.
I want to say, mostly because I just want people to know how cool my wife is. Thursday, August 11th is, you guys might not know this, and you might not even believe me if I tell you, but Thursday, August 11th is our 15th wedding anniversary that day. It's a big and day. I will be in Milwaukee with Brian. So, you know, sometimes the bear eats you and, you know, or whatever they say, but either way, we're going to be in Milwaukee on my anniversary, and I'm going to have to figure out a way to make it up to my wife. But I think I'll do that by taking her to Mexico next February.
Thank you, Rachel. Thank you, Rachel.
So we also have a couple shows coming up in Atlantic City. So slightly different than the one that we did at Ardmore and the one that we are doing with Riley Walker and the one in Denver. Those are all interview and a bunch of music. We're going to be doing 2 days at the Anchor Rock Club in Atlantic City on Saturday from 2 to 4. It's on the screen here, but for those of you listening, Saturday from 2 to 4 p.m., we're going to recap the Fish show, and then we're going to interview John Barber from the Disco Biscuits, and then he's going to play an acoustic set, which will be really fun. And that'll be Saturday 2 to 4, and then Sunday 2 to 4, also at Anchor Rock Club. We're going to be doing an auction. We're getting a bunch of amazing Fish vinyls, posters, gear, stuff like that from the Waterwheel Foundation. And we're going to auction that off as part of the show. And we're going to do an HF Pod recap and have some conversations and some fun. So that'll be live. It'll be streaming and it'll be live in AC at the Anchor Rock Club. So both shows are free. You just have to go to osirispod.com/osirislive for some more information. And we'd love to see you there. It's going to be great. So we have AC, Milwaukee and Denver coming up, and we're going to be doing live shows in addition to the live show. So it's all about live. Brian, how do you want to start? Do you want to start with our Bruce evangelizing?
Yeah, let's just go around quickly. And Matt, let's start with you. You are one of my favorite people to talk Bruce with. You've got a deep, deep knowledge for the dude. When we started this series on Bruce, you sent over a ton of recommendations for shows. And I will just say quickly, like from a structural standpoint, with Dave Matthews, we went through the first 10 volumes in order of live tracks. With Bruce, we're changing it up a little bit. We've built out a list of shows that we're going to go through. It should all be available for you all to listen to via Nugs. We'll be posting those a week in advance so that you're able to listen ahead of each show. But Matt had some great suggestions about what to dive into. And so, Matt, let's start with you. Tell us, what does the boss mean to you? When did you first encounter the boss? And what has happened when you've done wrong by the boss in your life?
I've never done wrong by the boss. that's the one thing I have never done. So Bruce has been a part of my life for my entire life. My parents were really big Springsteen fans ever since the early days of his career. My sort of Bruce flex is that my parents saw Bruce and the E Street Band many times pre-Born to Run, like 74-ish. He used to play, I'm from the Philadelphia area where RJ and I are sitting now. And, you know, Springsteen was, this was like, actually the first place that he got really, really big, thanks to, you know, being played on WMMR, which was a very, very progressive FM rock station in Philly. And Bruce used to play a lot of like colleges around here. And so they would see him at like Westchester University, Widener University. Pretty sure they saw him at the Main Point, not the Main Point show if you're familiar with Bruce's bootlegs, but another, because he played there a whole bunch of times. So and they actually, like, I think by the end of the 70s they like were not seeing him because it was like, oh, that, you know, Bruce blew up and, you know, he's like playing these big shows now. It was all different. But they raised me with the boss as I was a youngster born in the USA. Was a huge album that was always in rotation on our stereo at home. I knew that album inside and out by the time I was like 3 or 4 years old. And then in the 90s, you know, Bruce, we'll talk about this, I think, on some of our future episodes. The 90s were a difficult period for Bruce. He changed. He kind of dropped the E Street Band, wanted to go in a different direction, did a lot of acoustic stuff. You know, things like the Philadelphia soundtrack, Streets of Philadelphia. It was very, very different from the E Street Band. So I was very aware and I liked him, but it wasn't, it was kind of like that era of Bruce is like over. And then, Brian, I think we have a similar experience, which is that in 99, when he got the band back together and went on tour, I think we saw our first Bruce shows within like a week or two of each other on that tour. Philly 99 saw him. And I, even though I'd loved, you know, those records my entire life, seeing them live was like life-changing. I could not believe what I'd seen. And one of the things that we'll talk about, you know, throughout this series is how back then, like, there really wasn't a whole lot of live Bruce stuff that you could hear or see. It was basically just like the live 75, 85 box set. So I didn't really have a full appreciation of what E Street Band shows were like and saw that. And my mind was blown. It really kind of reinforced that live music had to be a very important part of my life. And so, you know, since then, and especially in the last like 10, 15 years, I've just tried to see them as many times as I can. You know, my wife, who is like not really familiar with Springsteen at all, has become a convert and loves to come see him and whatnot. And I've also gotten to have these sort of generational experiences of like, you know, going to shows with my parents and seeing Bruce and like all of us celebrating together. So it's really like a very, very kind of like core part of who I am as a music fan. It feels very like, you know, familial. It feels important. It feels like it's has to be a part of my life. And so I celebrate the E Street Band, and ever since they started releasing these live shows, I've collected every single one of them. I've listened to every single note, and it's just a very, very important part of, you know, the way I look at music today. So Brian, how about you?
Very, very similar, path as yourself. My parents often, and I appreciate you going as deep. I feel really similar about his overall career. My parents started dating, in the late 1970s, early 80s. One of their first dates was a Springsteen concert, and the River Tour is like continuously in our family, just like one of the most important tours in rock music, in music overall. That album is in my top 10 favorite records of all time. I was six months old at the time of this show that we're talking about here, 8/22/85. And basically from like the time I can remember anything, there was music in my house. And at the time it was Springsteen, it was the Beatles, it was U2, all of which have continued to this day. And then John Cougar Mellencamp at the time, which my parents have since, I've gone back and listened to a ton of his stuff from the 80s. My parents have kind of moved on, but Springsteen was everywhere. Tunnel of Love was still a huge record. I remember them going to see the Human Touch Lucky Town shows and coming back and having like, you know, their critiques about how things have changed, but it's still so good to see Bruce. And they kind of went through the same sort of thing in the 90s where there were hints and there were moments. The Blood Brothers documentary that came out, Murder Incorporated, there were moments where you were like, is he figuring out a way back? And I distinctly remember when the E Street Band reunion shows were announced, because correct me if I'm wrong, preceding that, they got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And was that the first time that they had played together when they did 10th Avenue Street Freeze Out?
No, that was after the reunion tour. I think that was, after. 2000 or 2001.
It
was like between the reunion and the Rising. It was somewhere in there.
Got it. Okay. I remember watching that in the house, but when the reunion was announced, we bought tickets for it and we sat on the floor at the United Center, and I will never forget like the lights going down and every single middle-aged person around me losing their goddamn mind. And one by one, the members of the E Street Band come out and like getting chills, just seeing little Steven come out. And then Bruce comes out last with that like iconic guitar, and that show, it's available on the live archives. It's an incredible show to listen to. But for me, beyond that like formative period, sometime in college when I got into Dylan, I really went back and started listening to whatever live Springsteen shows I could get my hands on, and just going back deeper in the catalog. And that was really where he became an artist for me. It was no longer an artist that my parents were passing me on to. It was an artist that I was listening to and diving deep into. Seen him a bunch of times in the years since then, and have found, as I've, and we're going to talk about this, as I've gotten a greater appreciation for two things. One, rock music in the 1980s, as well as artists making records post their commercial peak. Springsteen's been there as like a guiding light to try to understand what was happening in the 1980s from a rock music standpoint, as well as when you look ahead to like Human Touch and Lucky Town, which we'll talk about during this this series, what is going through an artist's mind, what is happening to an artist as they're evolving and as they're making choices that perhaps their larger fan base isn't fully on board with. So really, really excited to dive into this. And RJ, where are you at with the Boss Man?
So I think like most people, you know, I grew up like hearing Born in the USA, mostly like the songs from that album, and probably, you know, classic rock radio, obviously heard other, you know, I heard other songs, but you guys both helped me really understand and get into Bruce probably like starting about 5 years ago, maybe. And now I'm just like, I don't know, I'm on board. I mean, the first time I saw Bruce was at Jazz Fest 2006 after Katrina with the Secret Sessions band. And that was just like, not a typical Bruce show, obviously, but like an insane experience, for a lot of reasons. And, yeah, so I've been kind of catching up for the past several years, but now I would consider myself a pretty big fan and appreciating so much. Like going back to, I went back and like, you know, started with the first album and kind of like have caught up over the years. So I'm behind you guys, but I'm happy to be here. I guess I'll leave it at that because I think Bruce is fucking great.
He's fucking great. He's fucking great.
But my parents never listened to him.
That's interesting. RJ, have you mentioned the Jazz Fest show. Have you seen the E Street Band live?
I've never seen the E Street Band.
That's something that we're going to correct on the next tour.
Yep.
We've got to figure out a way for the three of us to get to a show together. But I guarantee you, wherever it is, on whatever stop on the tour it is, when you go, I will be there. And we're going to hold each other at, like brothers. And we're going to experience the power, the majesty.
I'll just say, Bruce, if you're listening, you know, just hook us up with some press passes. We'll come, we'll cover your show. We'll do a big breakdown. So if you're out there, if you're hanging right now, Nils, if you're listening, and anyone out there, we're happy to come to a Bruce show this upcoming tour.
So we talked earlier about how we're going to approach this. We are going to kind of jump around a little bit, but we have a pretty good flow for at least 10 of these. And we're starting in 1985 in East Rutherford, New Jersey, Giants Stadium. I mean, you know, he does a good job throughout the show of shouting out New Jersey and New York so that the New Yorkers don't feel left out by this show being in New Jersey. Because it's like, you know, practically New York. But Brian, there's been a lot of shows at Giants Stadium. What do you want to tell people about either 1985 or Giants Stadium before we jump into the show?
I'll give you a quick break. I mean, everyone knows the Giants and the Jets played Giants Stadium throughout the 80s, 90s. The Giants were there from 1976. It hosted seven matches in the 94 World Cup. It's just, you know, it was a dominant stadium in American culture in the late 20th century. To connect this to our last series where we focused on Dave Matthews, Dave Matthews Band played in the stadium 10 times from 98 to 2007. When Dave Matthews learned of the closing of Giants Stadium, he said, "I can't imagine I'll ever fall in love with a stadium like I did with Giants Stadium." And it has that lore of just being this Goliath of a arena stadium rock show, but like really being special in a lot of cases. Springsteen played there himself 24 times, including a 10-night run in the 2003 Rising Tour. And he wrote the song Wrecking Ball for his 2012 album of the same title about Giant Stadium. In terms of pop culture, there's one name that you need to remember about August 1985, and that is Michael J. Fox. Just a quick rundown here. The number one song in America is Huey Lewis's The Power of Love. The top five movies in America has two Michael J. Fox movies, Back to the Future and Teen Wolf. And in the top five TV shows in America at the time, number five is Family Ties. There is no greater peak in Michael J. Fox's career than August of 1985. We have reached that point.
My Back to the Future is my favorite movie of all time. And I'm really all bad time. At movies. All time. I've seen it, you know, 50 times probably. Every line, everything. I'm really bad at movies. Like there are many movies that you guys probably love that I've never seen, but I'm really good at watching Back to the Future. I just want to throw that out there. That's kind of peak 80s, you know?
This is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the other thing we have to mention if we're talking about music in the summer of 1985 is the big, you know, event that happens is Live Aid, which happened about a month before this. I've got an interesting piece of trivia for you guys. Bruce did not play at Live Aid, which a lot of people would say that's insane, because we'll talk about how he was like so unbelievably huge at this point, and also like somebody who has also always been very philanthropic and trying to bring light to, you know, various causes. He was in Europe. And so that's kind of like the reason why he was not at Live Aid, but he does have a connection to Live Aid. He made a huge contribution in one way. Do you guys know what his contribution was?
I'm totally stumped.
So,
did he write, do they know it's Christmas?
Yeah, We Are the World. It's actually a hidden Bruce John. On that tour, he was in Europe. He, in the days leading up to Live Aid, he had just played, I think it was a 4-night run at Wembley Stadium. And he left his stage there. So the Springsteen and E Street Band Summer 85 Stadium Tour stage is actually the Live Aid stage.
Oh, wow.
They just, you know, took the Bruce stuff down and put up the Live Aid scrims and everything like that. So it's actually kind of cool to think about the fact that, like, that stage, which he had just, there's really famous pictures of him at Wembley 85. And a couple days later, that same stage was like, you know, where Bono and Freddie Mercury had their legendary sets and stuff. So it's kind of cool to think about that connection, even though, I mean, what if he had played that day?
Right.
It would have been a totally different thing. But
That's wild to think about, especially like the way that Bono used that stage to like come down into the crowd during Bad. That's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, we need to talk about the show at some point, so we might as well do that now. I guess one of the things that stuck out to me, and you guys, I'm sure, have thoughts. I feel like this show, you know, it starts Born in the USA, Badlands. It seems like there's like this leveling. Leveling is the only word that comes to mind, like the leveling of Bruce's catalog in the 80s. It's almost like, and I think there's like pros and cons to that. Like, you know, the intro to Cover Me, you know, is another good example where it's like, it's kind of like everything is just sort of like, I don't want to say taken down a notch, but it's sort of like, it's all 80s-ized across the board, you know? And it's like, some of these songs are just like, they just sound so much different and a little more, I mean, they're just, it's like so 80s, but I think that's how his live shows developed, right? Like with the times, the sound changes like a lot of bands, but that's one thing that really stuck out to me. I mean, like the synth, you know, Born in the USA, obviously that's like a classic riff to open with, but just some of these songs felt a little more tepid to me, I guess is the way I would put it, because they all sound so incredibly 1985. And I guess there's pros and cons to that, but I'm curious if you guys agree with that or disagree with that.
It's an interesting take, and I guess I can agree to a certain extent. The way that I look at his shift, you know, it definitely was a big, you know, move towards the 80s sound with the synths and everything like that, because the sound of the E Street Band was always rooted in kind of like bar rock and, you know, things like the Detroit medley. It's like, you know, that's what people were like kind of listening to and dancing to in the early 70s in this kind of scene. I think, you know, one of the things that I had noted here is like, this period is the debut of Swole Bruce, right? He was like almost kind of like a skinny punk rocker kind of guy in the 70s with this like killer bar band, just sort of like doing things their own way. And then he emerges in the mid 80s. You know, he had started working out, lifting weights. He's much like bigger, stronger, which he, I think in his autobiography said it was really just to kind of build up his stamina for these long shows that he was doing and had the effect, but also like making him physically look this kind of heartland rock icon that he became. And he goes from like telling stories about his life in Jersey and the, you know, the conditions that he was dealing with and his relationship with his parents and stuff like that, to a very like kind of blue collar man of the people, you know, stumping for the, you know, the family farm and all that kind of stuff that you think about with, you know, 80s Bruce. It's the core is still there, but there's definitely like that kind of, I think, where his like modern day image, that, you know, goes back to 84, like that's where that all kind of started. But I do recognize that shift in the sound. I mean, everybody kind of was going that through that in the '80s too, with like implementing, you know, synthesizers and having new kind of sounds.
Yeah, true. Yeah. I mean, you brought up Live Aid. It's interesting because like you two didn't at that point, they kind of like got into it later, you know, but I think most bands were like, we're pushing that sound. Brian, what's your thought about that?
It's interesting because my complimentary thought is this is also the peak of Greatest Hits Bruce. Like if you think from this record prior, there's Born in the USA is a, I wouldn't say a challenging album to get into in any way. It was in the top 10 of the Billboard charts the entirety of this tour, which lasted from June 84 to October 85. So this is one of the most popular albums in America at the time and of all time. But at the same time, as we've noted, this is a significant change in the sound of Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band in a lot of cases. But also, you're looking back, you know, to Asbury Park coming out a decade and a half earlier. He doesn't really have, like, this is a point where there's no challenging moments in a set for listeners to kind of have to adjust to his new material. This whole set feels like a greatest hit set in a lot of cases, but along with that, it's all a greatest hit set filtered through his mid 1980s soundscape, which is very synth heavy, which is huge, huge drums, the bar band style, the kind of updated rockabilly style that he came out of the 1960s with is not really anywhere to be found aside from a few segments like towards the end of the show. The thing that's interesting to me though is of all the singer-songwriters that went into the 1980s with an established sound, Bruce is kind of the one who best capitalized on the sound of the 1980s and made it his own. I mean, this 1985, this is the year that Dylan puts out Empire Burlesque, which this is for a different podcast, but I love that album. But a lot of people will consider that to be one of his worst albums of all time. Neil Young is throwing synths into Crazy Horse albums in ways that, again, I love immensely, but a lot of people hate. Bruce Springsteen, though, like one of his biggest singles, a song that arguably more people know Bruce for than any other, Born in the USA, is completely directed by synths. So it makes sense to me that that would bleed into the rest of his material. I don't know if I hear it as like as leveling out and as kind of like this flattening of his sound in any sort of way. I just see, I hear what you're saying in terms of like, this is the era here and into the 1990s where when a big classic rock band puts out a new album, that sound bleeds into everything else that they've played before. And you mentioned U2. If you go 7 years later to the Zoo TV tour, everything that they play that's from the 1980s is going to kind of be filtered through where U2 is at in 1992.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, Matt, what are your thoughts going back to this show? I'm sure you've listened to it before, but what are we all kind of like had some themes to discuss. What stuck out to you?
I mean, this is, you know, you can argue which era of, you know, Bruce and the band that you like the most. I wouldn't say that the 84, 85 tour is my favorite, but it's hard to argue that this is really kind of like commercially Bruce's peak. I mean, like you said, Brian, you know, the album was on, you know, the Billboard top 10 for so long during this period. So many people, you know, became familiar with him at that point. There was sort of a new generation of fans ready. This tour started after the longest break that Bruce had had from live performing. Up to that point. I mean, they finished the River Tour in the UK or in Europe in 81. And then Bruce basically goes away for 3 years. Now, in that time, he writes and records and releases Nebraska and Born in the USA, which are sort of, you know, kind of sister albums. Sorry, my daughter's coming in here. So, that are kind of, you know, related with the material because they were written and recorded basically at the same time. But I think there was a whole lot of people that had not been old enough to go see Bruce live, you know, in 80, 81, who now were of concert going age and could go see this. So it's kind of a whole new audience to see this, you know, legendary live band. This is the first time he's ever played a stadium tour, you know, and he's selling out like multiple nights at places like Giant Stadium and, you know, the LA Coliseum and everywhere. And also internationally too. I mean, this is the point at which, like, you know, he really started to blow up all over the world. And as I looked at this night, I hear the show and they're so bombastic and amazing. I kept wondering, like, has anybody been this big since then? And could there ever be an artist who could be as big as they were in terms of like record sales and ticket sales and everything like that? I don't know. I don't know if it's possible anymore. I mean, the closest I can think of. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. What were you going to say?
I was just going to say the closest I can think of is like BTS, but also like the difference between BTS and Bruce is like, you know, none of us are BTS fans. I think they skew way, way younger. They're just like have a lot of young fans all around the globe. But like Bruce is kind of a generational thing. Like you can see at these shows, there was people from teenage years all the way up to probably their 50s who are super into Bruce at this point. So like, I don't know if that can ever happen again.
I feel like, Brian, I'm curious your thoughts. I mean, putting aside like pop and hip hop stuff that I don't know as much about, I feel like Coldplay at their peak probably was like sort of like this, just in terms of like filling 100,000 person stadiums around the world and like a more universal, somewhat universal appeal, you know, like everyone at least likes a couple Coldplay songs, you know, it's a totally different thing, but that's the only thing that comes to mind. Maybe there are other kind of like pop acts like that can, you know, but and like Chris Martin was like probably one of the biggest rock stars in the world there for a while, but that's like the only thing that comes to mind.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me think a lot about just how different music and pop culture were in the mid-1980s compared to today. Like what you just said, Matt, in terms of like the generational unity that you find of at a show like this, this is not appealing to one sector of like or one demographic. This is appealing to Americans. And this is really like American music in the mid-1980s. And anyone beyond this, like the only people I can really think of are bands. You know, I think about U2 in 1987 and 1988, or U2 in 92 and 93, just in terms of the success of the Joshua Tree tour, as well as Zoo TV. But that's a band. Like the thing that separates this is Bruce Springsteen is an individual that you can separate away from the E Street Band. If you're just kind of a casual fan, you can listen to a Bruce Springsteen record that has no E Street Band members on it, and they sell incredibly well. His name has the kind of cachet of a band in a way that really only like Dylan, Neil Young did from a classic rock standpoint. And if you go into the 90s, like 10, 12 years from now, the biggest stadium tours are going to be bands like the Rolling Stones, who are 30 years into their career, 30 plus years into their career at that point, and are really looked at as though they've reached their career peak and they're really just celebrating their career. Bruce is still making new music at this point in time. So
yeah.
I think that there's definitely a case to be made that outside of very specific pockets, this is as big as you could ever be. Definitely from a rock standpoint, this is as big as you could ever be as a performer.
You know, the in his autobiography, which I listened to, and he narrates, and it's fantastic. I know you guys have read the book, but this was also the year that he got married for the first time to Julianne Phillips, right? 85. And in the book, he talks about, like, we tried to have like a quiet wedding, and there was like a helicopter. You know, he was like, he seemed to be, or at least was feigning surprise at like the whole entertainment world was like interested in his wedding. And it seemed like that was like, he was just so big at that time. But to your point about how much different it was like you had to have a helicopter like flying over the where the wedding was. It's not like, you know, cell phones and leaked videos. It was like literally like you gotta have a helicopter if you want to try to see the wedding. So it's a pretty different time. But he seemed also pretty overwhelmed by the attention, right? I mean, do you guys see that as a kind of a theme throughout the career, like just how he, I don't know, how popular he became and how like kind of introverted he actually is, and like the kind of going back and forth between being the biggest rock star in the world and like trying to stay out of the spotlight?
Yeah, I mean, he talks about it just with regards to the amount of fame and attention that he received at this point in time, that this was really, he was able to survive in a great way by the early 1980s as a musician, but like this is really where he became wealthy beyond any sort of his imagination, and his response to that wealth is not like necessarily celebrating it. It's more like, well, I still have to keep living. This makes certain aspects of my life easier. I get to take care of people that I love. I don't have to worry about rent. Like, he thinks about wealth like you would imagine someone from a blue collar background would, where like, I've got my priorities in line. I get to take care of the people I love. And that's kind of it. Like, leave me alone outside of that. Obviously, like, his wealth and his attention and his notoriety has grown significantly in the 30 plus years since this. But you know, you think about Nebraska, I mean, that record was recorded 4 years prior on, you know, a four track recorder, and most of the Born in the USA demos were recorded quiet as well. It was only when, you know, he kind of ran into roadblocks and they recorded these as a full band, and it becomes this massive hit for him and for the E Street Band. So yeah, I think there is a sense at this point of like, what is everybody paying attention to? While at the same time, that working man, what drove him to almost madness when he made Born to Run, and what drove him to play 30 song, nearly 3 hour concerts where like there's no breaks aside from like a built-in set break. Like, when he's on stage, it is just so much high energy, and just like, there's so much coming at you as a listener. And to imagine him doing that over and over and over again, night after night, he's approaching this not necessarily as someone who feels like he's made it, almost as someone who's like, if I don't come out and perform tonight, like, everybody's going to turn away. And that's pretty fascinating to me.
It's worth, since this is the first of this series that we're doing, it's probably worth bringing up that like the experience of seeing the E Street Band live is something you really have to experience it in person. You can listen to these recordings and you can get a sense of it, but like, it's more like going to like church than to a concert. And I mean that in a great way. I mean, like, I was raised Catholic, which is a very like sort of sterile, like no fun allowed kind of experience. And I would see things like, you know, gospel churches, like the scene in the Blues Brothers where people are like literally doing backflips down the aisle and stuff like that. And I was like, why can't church be like that? Like that would be cool. That's what a Springsteen show is like. I mean, you
totally
lose control of your facilities. I mean, he just knows how to work the room in a way that you come out at the end feeling like cleansed and feeling healed and just sweaty and tired. And, you know, you were just mentioning like playing all these long shows. I remember one time I saw him 10 years ago. It was still one of the best concerts I've ever been to in my entire life. And the next day, it was the first night of a two-night run, and I wanted to go back the next night, and I couldn't because I was so exhausted from that show. I mean, it was like a 3-hour and 45-minute show, no set break, just taking it to the crowd the whole time. And then I'm like, how is this guy who's like in his 60s at this point, like, gonna play another rock and roll show like that tonight, and he's going to do the same thing. He's going to blow it up.
That's how I feel about Fish today, by the way.
Yes, true. I
was like, I could just stream it from the couch. It wouldn't be 115 degrees. But they're going to come out and do it again. But you're right. I mean, the performance is just, I mean, it's incredible. And I do like, that's a good point, Matt. And I like how the live shows, like I love the late 70s shows, you know, like the 78, 79 and the earlier. I mean, he gets better at it over time, right? Like his like church act thing like gets more elaborate and more kind of like epic over time. It seems like he just some of the stories, you know, I mean, like the Pink Cadillac monologue, it's just, I don't know how often he did that thing, but I mean, it's really long and really, really detailed, you know, about Adam and Eve and Pop-Tarts and David Letterman. And then it goes back to I got the keys to the Pink Cadillac. And you're like, what the fuck is going on here, man? It's incredible. But he does take this like evangelical preacher approach, which I think, I mean, that kind of like grew over time, right? It wasn't like that, like in the early days, but it seems like it became like a central part of the show.
Yeah. And there's an aspect about that, that part of the show that it's really fascinating to me within the context of this period in time, because 1985, this is peak Reagan Revolution era. This is, and he's selling out stadiums to, you know, 70, 80,000 people around the world. And you're listening to this show, you know, the funniest thing forever will be when Republican candidates use Born in the USA as campaign slogans or campaign songs, which happens way more than it actually should. Like, come on.
Yeah.
Like, listen to the lyrics, guys.
You just really got to listen to the lyrics.
You can print them out. There's an internet. You could just type it into Google.
There wasn't, though.
There was not.
Someone had to, like, fax the lyrics.
It's just a guy in a bandana and a jean jacket going, mm-hmm. Born in the USA. And like, all right, cool. Mm-hmm. The thing that fascinated me listening to this is how, and a couple other volumes, couple volumes later that we'll talk about next week, is how outwardly he is about his political values and political ideals. And he's in both places, he is the most commercially successful, or one of the most commercially successful musicians of this period in time. He is drawing in 70, 80,000 people on a nightly basis. And yet he is talking in a way that is very progressive, that is very liberal minded, that's very much like caring about every man. Like, hey, we really need to be paying attention to factory towns that are closing down. This is all over his songwriting. This entire album, it's fascinating to me. I went back and listened to Born in the USA for, I don't know, the 450th time in the last 2 years. I don't know. I love this album. So many of these songs are small stories told in the biggest way possible. And it kind of speaks to, you know, the church element of this. And it gets to like what he's talking about with Cadillac, Pink Cadillac, is like, this is a guy who clearly absorbs spirituality and clearly absorbs the idea that there's a good and an evil, and that we want to be on the side of good, but like goodness is blurred in a lot of cases. You know, he talks through the Pink Cadillac monologue about like the idea of making love as sin, and that in the moment, in the Garden of Eden, this was like the most beautiful thing in the world. And then Satan comes along and it changes everything. And it distorts the entire experience. And he presents this perspective of someone who really loves living, but also knows the massive challenges of living. And then turns that into stories about everyday people and small towns that you just pass through or pass by on the interstate and don't even give a second thought to, and are a part of all of our lives and are a part of this changing society we're in. But he's taking all of these small stories and bringing them to the biggest stages possible. So there's that church element to it. There's that Dylan storytelling folk quality element to it, all kind of filtered through massive drums, massive synthesizers, Clarence Clemens sax solos that will just like fill your soul up with goodness. And it creates this experience that he's really built off of this tour to today's. Like, I feel like this tour, he models a lot of shows today, even to the energy and to the experience of what he was doing throughout the Born in the USA tour. But it's wild to think about these songs as like, and this experience of seeing him in a smaller setting, and to see him, you know, if he was playing in a bar in 1985, he would be bringing the exact same amount of energy, the exact same amount of passion to these shows.
Matt, what, if you want to comment on that, you should, but I know you had some other thoughts, and we're not going to, you know, go through all 29 tracks because we just, we can't. But what other thoughts do you have about this show, Matt?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's amazing that these intimate moments, these storytelling moments, which he's adding, you know, he's kind of started that with the River tour a little bit. And now he's added more here. Yeah. Now it's a really, really big, important part of his shows to this day, that him just like talking and sharing these things works in a stadium. I mean, you can hear like the crowd is still kind of like with him energetically, but they hush down enough that like they're receiving what he's saying, with, you know, hanging on every word, which seems to be like a pretty amazing thing that he's able to accomplish. And once again, even if you listen to, you know, a live recording and you're thinking that these moments are kind of like boring and you want to just skip to the music or whatever, those are the best moments of the show. You know, I mean, when you're seeing him live in the room, everybody is just like waiting with bated breath. And when the moment comes and he's talking and then he just starts playing the River, it's like, oh, man, he sets the stage so well for you to be emotionally like ready to go to receive songs. And I think he's probably the best ever at doing that.
Agree.
I mean, it's pretty different from like, you know, we all love like the Dead and Fish and other live bands that just like, they just come out on stage and they just start playing and then they stop playing and then they leave. And that's like, you know, with the exception of like, you know, everyone telling them people to take a step back or whatever, or like, you know, little things, but it's so much different to have this be part of the experience, you know, which I do think as like someone who, I mean, I love like the first six Bruce albums. Like, I listen to all of them a lot. And I think when you start listening to live shows, it is a little bit like distracting, you know, because you're like, okay, all right, like get to the song. Like, it's like 5 minutes of him talking. But I think the more, if you pay attention, it is like an essential part of it. And it's pretty unique, like you said. Not many people can do that.
I think related to that too, is the fact that this is a, you know, enormous stadium tour. Even before this, he was doing multi-night runs in arenas all over the country, selling those out. It's obviously this big, big tour, which seems to serve the big bombastic sound of the Born in the USA album. But also at the same time, he kind of Trojan horsed in the fact that this is also sort of a tour for Nebraska. And he's got these segments in the show where it's him on acoustic guitar in front of 80,000 people playing these quiet songs. And he's such a master of like giving you like these energetic, great segments, but then dropping it down and being like, all right, it's going to be story time. And I'm going to sing something really personal to you for the next, you know, 10, 15 minutes. And it's, I can't imagine anybody else being able to drive the dynamics of the show like that.
Yeah. I mean, the Atlantic City is really, really great. It's a, like, what an amazing song that is.
Especially because we were talking about this in the parking lot last night at the Fish show, because it was like the song was playing. If anybody is of the opinion that the band's version of Atlantic City is better than Bruce's, I think you've probably only heard the Nebraska version of Atlantic City, and you should listen to a live version from the East Street Band, because 100%. It's the best.
When we, you know, that Goose covered Atlantic City at the Radio City show on the night that Trace said, and someone on the internet or I can't remember, but someone like told me like, yeah, they covered the band. And I was like, it's not
the band.
It's not how this works, guys. I'm sorry. All respect to the band.
I'm curious really quick, and I want to, go off outline here. we haven't said a ton about like the songs that are played here, and just to give people a sample of like segments to check out. I'm curious if you guys have like a 3 to 5 song segment of the show that you think really stands up as like a hot segment for someone to check out to get an idea of what this show is about.
All of it.
And the whole show is a good option as well.
I mean, this is actually a good place to start because his catalog is so deep at this point. You do have different segments. You know, he starts out kind of classic riverish Bruce, and then he gets into the newer material for a little while. Then he goes back to the 70s where he's doing like, you know, Thunder Road, Promised Land, stuff like that, brings it back to the 80s. And then does, which I'll talk about in a second, like the classic kind of last quarter of the show, Bruce thing. I mean, it's really, I would say, you know, maybe that's my recommendation, but if you're new to Bruce and you want to get a sense of all of the different flavors, this is a great place to start.
Agree.
Yeah. I mean, I the whole show is great. I think there is a segment, the Thunder Road, Cover Me, Dancing in the Dark, Hungry Heart, Cadillac Ranch through, I mean, the rest of the show, but there's like a solid 6 songs that are just awesome. What about you, Brian?
Yeah, I was going to say set 2, just because I think like it really showcases where he is at from that sound to get Cover Me, Dance in the Dark, Hungry Heart, Cadillac Ranch, Downbound Train, I'm on Fire, Pink Cadillac, the big story in there, and then Bobby Jean ending things out before Little Steven will come out for the encore, which is just an incredible moment at the time. But also like the first 7 songs, if you go Born in the USA through the river, you've got like a capturing right there of some of the best. You got Darkness stuff, you've got the river stuff, you've got Born in the USA. Like you just have like a full smattering of where Bruce was at from the last 7 years. It's really, really remarkable.
The one thing that's actually missing from this show, which is kind of crazy to think about, is Rosalita. He, on this tour, after closing his main set with Rosalita every single night since he had written the song, he finally got sick of it and stopped playing it for a very, very long time, even through the reunion tour and all that kind of stuff. It was sometime in the aughts that he actually started playing.
I saw it in 2003. I don't know if it was like a bust out, but it was, I remember he started playing it, my parents losing their mind.
He plays a little bit more now, but like for a very long time, it was kind of like a treat if you got Rosalita. Like that was a special night for the tour, which is crazy because that's, I mean, of all the things they've ever done live, Rosalita is like the centerpiece of, you know, Bruce live greatness.
That VHS of his videos from the, I don't know when it came out, but it's like 1975 through, I think the last video is War from the 75 to 85 live box set. And it opens with Rosalita with the girls on stage chasing Bruce down. And like, it's just such a classic moment.
Man, can you imagine if he was part of that? I mean, I just watched Live Aid last Friday night again. I mean, I watch it like once a month. But can you imagine if Bruce was a part of that too? Because the Bowie, Queen, U2, I mean, it's so epic. I can't even imagine. Like that would have been pretty outrageous. Well, guys, we have to wrap up in a second because we actually have to do another live show in just a couple minutes. And for those of you listening, thank you for listening. We're gonna try the awards for the live Bruce shows. The one is gonna be the most boss moment of the show. Brian, what do you got?
That first time that man touched a woman.
Pink Cadillac monologue. The whole thing. I was sitting there with my son listening to it, and I was like, oh, Bruce is about to speak. Bruce is about to speak. You got to listen. And he was like, what is he talking about? I was like, you'll learn it in middle school. What do you got, RJ?
I mean, there's so many great stories, and I do really appreciate the like heartfelt kind of activism, especially before my hometown. And the fact that he's like, during the set break, you can go out and you can find the phone number of this organization, and then you can call them and find out how to get involved. It's just a funny way to think about activism, but that's how it went in the 80s. But right before Hungry Heart, he just has a great line where it's right after Dance in the Dark and before Hungry Heart, he's like, and they call this work. And then he goes into and then goes into Hungry Heart, which I just, that's just a great line. Matt, what do you got?
For me, it's a pretty like long moment. It's not a very specific thing, but it's the last quarter of the show, which is, once again, to educate you if you've not been through the experience, basically what happens at a certain point, like for the encore, is they just turn the house lights on and they're on for the rest of the show. And he does stuff like the Detroit medley, like, you know, Twist and Shout, all that stuff. And what happens is you realize when the lights come on after, you know, it's probably been 3 hours at this point, how much everybody in the entire venue is just losing their mind. You've never seen so much bad white person dancing in one. Well, I guess at a fish show, but like seriously. And I'll share this video that I sent these guys. It's from around that same period. And you see actually with the lights on, he's doing the Detroit medley and it's mostly focused on the crowd. And I sent it to these guys. I'll share it on Twitter after this, so you can go watch, but it really gives you the sense of like the madness of a Bruce show. So check that out.
This is awesome, guys. I'm so excited to keep this going. Thank you guys for bearing with us. We do have people watching, so I think that our proof of concept of moving from one artist live releases to another is going to work, and we're going to be back tomorrow. We have to listen to 7 hours of music between now and tomorrow because we have to listen to a Fish concert, and then we'll have to listen to that again to do a recap, and the next Bruce show, which is going to be 12/12/75. I'm excited to go back to 75 from Greendale, New York. I think that's it, guys. I think that's the show. Matt, thank you for bringing all your commentary and expertise. It's fun to have you here.
Yeah, looking forward to doing this with you guys.
And awesome, for anyone watching here who wants to hop over to HF Pod, which is going to start momentarily, we're going to talk about last night's Fish show. And thanks for those of you who are listening to the podcast. Thank you for listening, share, review, help get us out there in front of more people. And we'll see you guys tomorrow.
See you soon.
Osiris.